KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We've got to make sure that voters don't think that we're completely out of touch with how they live their lives, with their values, and what they believe is important.
Some Democrats protested President Trump during his joint address to Congress. Where does their party go from here?
Today's Wednesday, March 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Trump's nominee to lead the National Institutes of Health clashed with the agency during the pandemic.
Some of his positions have been at odds with the scientific establishment.
If confirmed, I will establish a culture of respect for free speech and science and scientific dissent at the NIH.
And many Christians mark Ash Wednesday with a cross of ashes on their forehead.
For those who lost their homes and churches during the Los Angeles fires, it's especially poignant.
It was absolutely surreal to see flames coming off the top of those crosses.
Those stories in this hour of All Things Considered. First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump has decided to give the automakers in the U.S. a break on those steep tariffs on imports of goods from Canada and Mexico. But as NPR's Maura Lyson reports, the exemption will only last till April 2nd.
The exemption is the latest in a series of whiplash moves on tariffs. 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico took effect Tuesday. Then the big three automakers, GM, Ford, and Stellantis, lobbied the White House saying they would be hit hard because their supply chains are so integrated between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And the president agreed, says White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
The president is giving them an exemption for 1 month so they are not at an economic disadvantage.
The reprieve recognizes the free trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada that Trump himself negotiated in his first term to replace NAFTA. Until now, there were no tariffs on anything between these three giant trading partners. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
After the U.S. doubled its tariffs on Chinese products Tuesday, China quickly responded with higher import taxes on U.S. soybeans. Rachel Kramer with Iowa Public Radio reports this does not bring relief to soybean farmers in the Midwest.
Roughly half of soybeans grown in the U.S. are exported, and many of them go to China. Iowa State University Extension economist Chad Hart says this makes the crop more vulnerable to retaliatory tariffs than some other commodities. But Hart says the economic damage depends largely on whether the tariffs are long-term or a temporary negotiating tool.
The speed at which these tariffs go in means that they can also be taken away just as quickly.
The American Soybean Association is urging the Trump administration to reconsider its tariffs and continue negotiations with trade partners. The association says soybean farmers are still recovering from the 2018 trade war with China. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Kramer in Des Moines.
L.A. County and two Southern California cities are suing one of the largest utilities in the country over the Eaton Fire, which killed at least 17 people and burned more than 14,000 acres in January. Member Station LAist McKenna Sievertson has more.
L.A. County and the cities of Sierra Madre and Pasadena filed separate but similar lawsuits against Southern California Edison, claiming its equipment started the fire in Eaton Canyon on January 7th. The lawsuits allege that SoCal Edison didn't de-energize all of its electrical equipment in the area, despite being warned of the extreme weather conditions and fire risk. The utility is also accused of having negligently failed to safely inspect and maintain its equipment and surrounding vegetation. The lawsuits look to cover damages from the Eaton Fire. A SoCal Edison spokesperson told LAist the utility is reviewing the lawsuits and will address them through the appropriate legal process. For NPR News, I'm McKenna Sievertson in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 485 points today. This is NPR. The Internal Revenue Service is the latest large federal agency to come under the DOGE cost-cutting knife, obviously not at the ideal time with tax filing season underway and millions of Americans looking for speedy refunds. The Associated Press says people familiar with the situation but not authorized to speak on the record say the IRS is drafting plans to cut its current workforce of 90,000 roughly in half. Former IRS Commissioner John Koskinen saying such a move would leave the agency essentially dysfunctional. A mission to map the location of water deposits on the moon appears to have failed. As Joe Palco reports, Lunar Trailblazer had a successful start on its trip to the moon last week, but problems arose soon after launch.
According to a statement from NASA, the problems are related to power. Mission managers believe the spacecraft is spinning, so its solar panels are unable to generate sufficient power for normal operations. Although it's still possible the probe can be commanded to control the spin and restore something close to normal power levels, the time for critical trajectory correction maneuvers has already passed. The probe can no longer reach the lunar orbit its instruments were designed for. Lunar Trailblazer is one of a new class of lower-cost but higher-risk planetary probes. Its $94 million budget is less than a tenth that of some of NASA's flagship missions. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Makers of some popular anti-obesity drugs are cutting prices. Danish drug maker Novo Nordisk saying it will drop prices for Wegovy by 23%. The new price available for both people with insurance that doesn't cover weight loss drugs and those without it. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. 100 minutes. That's how long President Trump had the floor literally last night. 100 minutes that he used to lay out his agenda, his grievances, and what he argued are the accomplishments of his first 6 weeks in office. This all came during his joint address to Congress, the State of the Union that's not quite a State of the Union. The historic length of his speech is an apt metaphor for the degree to which Trump and his fellow Republicans have dominated since he returned to office in January. There's been little room left for Democrats to make their case to the American people, but exactly what is the case they want to make? That is a question that Matt Bennett and his fellow moderate Democrats tried to answer at a recent Democratic retreat. Bennett is executive vice president for public affairs at Third Way, which is a centrist Democratic think tank, and he joins me now. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
Last night, we saw protests from House Democrats during President Trump's speech. Congressman Al Green of Texas was thrown out. Some other lawmakers walked out. Other lawmakers held up placards or they wore T-shirts with messages of protest. I just want to ask you, this style of protest, do you think it's effective?
I really don't. Look, I share their passion. I understand their anger, and I share the anger. I feel it every single day. I just don't think that's what we need to be doing as a party right now, because I think ultimately our job is to win back the votes of voters that left us, the people that either stayed home or voted for Republicans in 2024. And I really don't think that those kinds of displays are what those voters are looking for. They're looking for a party that is more reasonable in their view than Trump and the Republicans. I think we have an opportunity to win that battle, but probably not through displays like that.
I want to turn now to the retreat that you helped organize in February. You got a group of moderate Democrats together for a day and a half, and I understand that was a group that included some elected officials, consultants, folks who worked on campaigns. In a couple of words, what was the vibe like?
Well, look, it was, you know, 3 weeks into the Trump administration, so the vibe was pretty downbeat. I think everybody there was fairly grim and clear-eyed about the depth of the hole that Democrats find ourselves in at the moment. So we did a lot of hard thinking about what we're saying to voters on cultural issues like immigration and crime and other things, and on the economy. And I think we all agree that we have work to do in both areas.
Give us a sampling of what some of those conversations were like among you and your fellow Democrats.
Well, I think one thing that we concluded was voters felt like, first of all, that we had lost that battle for reasonableness, that somehow Donald Trump, who, in my view at least, is the most unreasonable national figure maybe in the history of American politics, beat us and was able to argue that he would restore order where the Democrats were offering chaos at the border, in the grocery store, on the streets. Now, we have a huge opportunity because he is not restoring order. He is bringing chaos of his own. But we can't rely on that to win, we've got to make sure that voters don't think that we're completely out of touch with how they live their lives, with their values, and what they believe is important. So we can't simply minimize their fears about immigration or about crime. And we can't talk to them about the economy and just say, look, the macroeconomic numbers are great when many people are living right close to the edge and just trying to keep body and soul together. And I think that is where Democrats fell short as a party, not individual candidates, but as a party. And that's where we must improve.
I've heard you say several times that your party appears to have lost the battle for reasonableness. How does it win it back?
Well, some of that is contrast. And I think what we must do is make clear that what Trump is doing now is deeply unreasonable. And as Senator Slotkin pointed out last night, I think very effectively, the kinds of reforms that he promised might be good, but the kinds of cuts that he's bringing are not. He, instead of a scalpel, Musk is literally bringing a chainsaw to the federal government and cutting things that nobody voted to cut. Nobody went to the polls and voted to stop research in Alzheimer's or cancer. Nobody wanted to cut the Park Service employees that clean the bathrooms or air traffic controllers or veterans who are trying to help other veterans in crisis. No one voted for that. And Democrats must make sure that people understand that that's what they're getting in the second Trump term. So setting the contrast is vital. And then talking about the issues that people care about in ways that they can really relate to, I think, is also very important, which is, again, why I thought Senator Slotkin's response was quite good. She talked about the economy in very realistic and very simple terms, and we've got to keep that up.
That was Matt Bennett. He's the Executive Vice President for Public Affairs at Third Way. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Today is Ash Wednesday. Many Christians mark the beginning of Lent by marking their foreheads with the sign of a cross in ash. For those whose homes and churches burned in the Los Angeles area fires earlier this year, the symbol is especially poignant. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports.
Palisades Presbyterian sits on a rise overlooking the Pacific. The church caught fire and burned down on the first night of the fires.
It was absolutely surreal to see flames coming off the top of those crosses.
Grace Park is walking through the rubble.
And if you come up these stairs here, this is where the back entrance of the church used to be.
For nearly two decades, she's served as one of the pastors here.
I am constantly reminding folks in church, reminding myself as well, that the church is not a building, but it is her people.
But she admits that reassurance can feel like cold comfort.
The reality is that this is our home. We do live here, and we are surrounded by the things in our lives that mean something to us. The photos mean something to us. That special coffee cup that you used every morning, it meant something to you. We need to take the moment to grieve them.
My neighbor pulled up and ran to the door and said, quick, grab your dog and your purse and let's go. And I never saw my house again.
Among those grieving the loss of her home and her church is 91-year-old Sylvia Boyd. She's been a member of Palisades Presbyterian for some 30 years.
I just know at my church, we always worked and prayed and did everything we could to help everybody who needed help.
Boyd is now living with her daughter near Sacramento. It's been a hard few months. Her husband died right before Christmas, and her church and home burned down right before his memorial service.
I do hope that there is something on the horizon that will come, and I know it will. And if you're lucky like me, you've got a family. It will take you in, along with your dog.
On the other side of L.A. County, Carrie Patterson Grinden is opening the door of her congregation's temporary home.
So this is the former rectory of St. Barnabas Church in Eagle Rock. It's sort of a multi-purpose space.
Grinden is the longtime rector of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Altadena. The building burned down on the first night of the fires.
Receiving both the good news that our house was still standing and then this unimaginable news that the church was gone. I don't even know. It was unbelievable to try to hold all that.
Hold it for both herself and for her parishioners.
losing the space where we've worshiped together over the years and all of those really holy moments, seeing it all gone was just excruciating, honestly.
We move forward after seeing lives in ashes.
88-year-old Betty Butler is a retired librarian who's been a member of St. Mark's for more than a quarter century.
The ashes will scatter. They'll return to the earth. There'll be things that are painful, and we'll get through them. But we have our faith, and we have a promise.
A promise of hope in the midst of despair.
Faith calls you to not give up, but to give to.
That's a nuance that resonates with 18-year-old Maggie Arnzen-Samoa. She began attending St. Mark's in first grade when she and her two fathers joined the congregation.
When I first heard that the church was burnt down, it was through my dad. And that was the first time I saw him cry in the whole ordeal. The church wasn't just a place where I felt safe, but my family felt safe.
Safe is something Arnzen-Samoa longs to feel again. And it's something she's making her spiritual practice this Lent.
There's been a lot of trauma, and I think it's good to give up something more emotional that I've been feeling. Anger or resentment, I think those are things that I'd love to let go and move forward.
Forward together, says her pastor, Carrie Patterson Grinden.
Really incredible to see people come together in the midst of their grief and their loss without skipping over any of that and holding each other up and remaining one in the midst of a really unimaginable loss.
Facing so much profound loss makes this Lent different, says Grace Park of Palisades Presbyterian.
The symbol of Lent is ashes, and we are definitively surrounded by ashes. The imagery of ashes is destruction and loss and grief.
It's a season, Park says, that reminds humans of their fragility and God's solidarity with them.
God loves us. God weeps with us. And God walks with us through the ashes.
Through loss and grief, not around it. Back at the ruins of Palisades Presbyterian Church, Park stands on dusty ground and points to a spot in the rubble. A few days after the fire, she and some others hiked to this site.
And right in there, inside of those ashes, is where we pulled out the chancel cross.
The cross at the front of the church, in the midst of despair, a sign of hope on the path to Easter and new life. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. A Stanford University health researcher faced intense Senate questioning today during his confirmation hearing to become director of the National Institutes of Health. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to talk about what happened. Hi there.
Hey there.
So, Rob, just to start, the NIH is the world's biggest public funder of medical research, often at the center of debate. So I imagine there was a whole lot to talk about today. Just start by filling us in on this nominee. Who is he?
He is a doctor named Jay Bhattacharya. He's a very well-respected health economist at Stanford, but Bhattacharya has taken some contrarian, sometimes controversial positions that put him at odds with the scientific establishment. Most notably, Bhattacharya opposed lockdowns during the pandemic, and that was dismissed as ill-informed and dangerous by most scientists, but Bhattacharya has been defiant, and during today's hearing, he told senators he would allow more open debate as head of the NIH.
If confirmed, I will establish a culture of respect for free speech in science and scientific dissent at the NIH. Over the last few years, top NIH officials oversaw a culture of cover-up, obfuscation, and a lack of tolerance for ideas that differed from theirs. Dissent is the very essence of science.
And you know, Bhattacharya says he was shunned by the scientific community for his views, including by the NIH, and he just doesn't want to see that happen to anyone else.
Rob, Bhattacharya would take over the NIH at a pretty tough time. Walk us through some of the details.
Yeah, so the NIH is one of the federal agencies that's reeling from layoffs and restrictions. More than 1,200 of the agency's 18,000 employees were sacked. A Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson said the cuts were part of the broader effort to restructure and streamline the federal government. The NIH's ability to award billions of dollars for research has also been stymied. At the same time, the administration wants to slash what the NIH pays universities, medical schools, and hospitals for so-called indirect costs, you know, basically overhead. And all of this has left the NIH demoralized, fearful, and confused. Several senators pressed Bhattacharya about all this, including the cap on indirect costs. That's been challenged as illegal. Here's an exchange with Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire.
If directed by the president to take action that would break the law, would you follow the law or would you follow the president's directive?
Senator, I don't believe the president will ever ask me to break the law.
Well, that strains credulity, given especially the last few weeks, and it's a disappointing answer. I will expect you to follow the law regardless of whether the president directs you to break it.
Bhattacharya did promise to look into rehiring some of those fired workers and getting the NIH's funding flowing again, and then he would examine the plan on indirect costs. And this afternoon, a federal judge in Boston issued a preliminary injunction blocking the indirect cost cap from being implemented.
Rob, one of the other concerns that we've heard about is political ideology influencing science. Did that come up?
Yes. Democratic Senator Edward Markey from Massachusetts pressed Bhattacharya about that. Let's listen to a little bit of that exchange.
Will you commit here today to reinstating funding for scientists whose funding has been terminated because their research does not align with MAGA ideology?
Senator, I don't believe that ideology ought to determine whether one gets research or not. I believe very fundamentally in
funding research on the mental health conditions of the LGBTQ community. That should not be a basis for canceling funding for research. Is that what you're saying?
If confirmed, I'll go look carefully into that.
But overall, Bhattacharya got a pretty positive reception from the committee, especially from the Republicans, and he's expected to be easily confirmed by the full Senate.
We've been talking with NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration is trying to squeeze Iran's economy by targeting its most precious export, oil. President Trump wants to reduce Iran's crude exports to zero, but Iran's economy has already been in free fall for months. NPR international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
In early December, Maryam, a 43-year-old accountant from the city of Rasht along Iran's Caspian Sea, went to visit her father in the hospital. He was in the ICU for complications from Parkinson's disease. Maryam, who did not want her last name used out of fear of government retribution, said just one day earlier her father had been alert and lively. She was stunned at how much his condition had deteriorated overnight.
My father was unconscious. He didn't move or wave at us as he did just one day before that. He was connected to some new machines. It was the same thing for many of the other patients in ICU.
Maryam and other families asked what had gone wrong.
We finally found out that there had been a power cut for more than 2 hours, causing all the ICU machines to fail. The backup generator also didn't work.
Maryam says it took her father 4 days to recover from the power blackout. Electricity cuts and rolling blackouts are now pervasive in Iran, affecting businesses, emergency services, and the health and welfare of millions of Iranians.
They've had to shut offices, schools, and some companies for many days. All of these are a great harm to the economy.
That's Mohammad Mahebi, an engineer working in Iran's electricity sector for nearly 20 years. He says it's ridiculous that a country which has some of the world's largest oil and gas reserves is facing an energy crisis. Mohebi says it's due to government missteps and crippling international sanctions.
The first and most important reason is mismanagement and corruption. Then the sanctions add to it by stopping any possibility of investments.
Adnan Mazri is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, a U.S. think tank. He says the economy is also in shambles. Poverty is high, the banks are in considerable trouble, and inflation is running about 30%.
The prices of food items and medicines have been rising and then become more scarce.
Mazri says it's unlikely the government will undertake reforms to repair the economy. He says too many players are enriching themselves in Iran.
This is a government that is interested in heavy control of the economy. And corruption is systemic and has reached legendary levels.
And the economic outlook is likely to get worse, says Javad Salehi Isfahani, a professor of economics at Virginia Tech, focusing on the Middle East and Iran. He says the Trump administration recently reimposed the so-called maximum pressure campaign, designed to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon by increasing sanctions and cutting its oil exports to zero.
Iran dependent on oil exports to import capital goods, to import intermediate goods that runs the factories, and also food and other consumer goods.
President Trump says he's willing to negotiate a deal, which Salehi Isfahani says could offer Iran some relief from sanctions. But
I think a lot of advisors in Washington are telling him that Iran is very weak, and it's easy to get to agree to a bad deal from Iranian side.
Salehi Isfahani says Iran may feel pressure to join talks, but it's unlikely to sign up to anything definitive for now. Salehi Isfahani says Iran has shown for the past 4 decades that it's resilient, no matter how dire the economy. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Community organizers in North Carolina are trying to protect people without legal status by spotting and helping them avoid immigration agents. Borders Our Tom Holman is saying these efforts interfere with the rule of law. But community organizers say all they're trying to do is help their neighbors. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is calling for cuts to the military's budget.
He says climate change isn't part of the Pentagon's mission.
Defense Department is not in the business of climate change, solving the global thermostat. We're in the business of deterring and winning wars.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Vice President J.D. Vance visited the U.S.-Mexico border today in a trip meant to showcase the Trump administration's tough immigration policies. NPR's Adrian Florido reports he was joined by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard.
The trio took a helicopter tour of the border at Eagle Pass, Texas, before meeting with law enforcement officials. Afterward, the vice president touted the big decline in illegal border crossings since President Trump took office.
It turns out we didn't need new laws. We didn't need fancy legislation. We just needed a new president of the United States, and thank God that's exactly what we have.
In fact, crossings started plummeting in the final months of the Biden administration, though Vance said it was because would-be crossers knew Trump was on his way. He said Trump wants to complete the entire southern border wall by the end of his term, and that the government is working to speed up the pace of deportations, saying, quote, Rome wasn't built in a day. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
U.S. indicted 12 Chinese citizens, it says, were behind a hacker-for-hire operation. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
The Justice Department investigation found a private Chinese cybersecurity company helped the Chinese government agencies hack into the email accounts and private databases of companies, universities, and individuals, many of whom were in the United States. Last year, that company, called iSoon, had hundreds of pages of internal company communications in their target lists leaked online by an anonymous source. Now the U.S. Department of Justice says it's connected iSoon and Chinese security agents who paid them for their services to multiple cybersecurity breaches. A senior Justice Department official says by using private hacking companies, the Chinese government was looking for, quote, a form of plausible deniability. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. For over 5 hours, lawmakers in Congress questioned the mayors of four Democratic cities today about their laws and policies concerning people who are in the U.S. illegally. As NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports, the mayors defended their use of taxpayer money to address the needs in their cities.
The mayors of Chicago, Boston, Denver, and New York were summoned to Washington to defend their so-called sanctuary city policies. Those policies generally limit local law enforcement from participating in federal immigration and customs enforcement activity. Supporters argue this preserves trust in local law enforcement and leaves federal law enforcement to federal agencies. Critics say there's a lack of cooperation bordering on obstruction and at odds with President Trump's goals to increase deportations. The Democratic mayors also said that much of their recent policy has been in response to Republican governors sending recently arrived migrants to their cities on buses. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
The Internal Revenue Service, IRS, is considering deeper staffing cuts to its workforce of 90,000 people. The tax collection agency has already cut more than 6,000 jobs under the Trump administration and is considering tens of thousands more. Analysts say reducing tax enforcement could cost the government more money by making it easier for the wealthy to avoid paying what they owe. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher today after a choppy day of trading. The Dow was up. This is
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today, a sharply divided Supreme Court limited the Trump administration's sweeping efforts to eliminate foreign aid. The justices voted 5-4 to uphold a lower court order. That ruling said the government must pay foreign aid contractors for work they've completed. It's about $2 billion of money that Congress already authorized. This puts the justices at the center of an intense partisan fight. It's a position that was on full visual display during last night's presidential address to Congress. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here in the studio. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Ari.
To start with that address last night, President Trump talked about the Supreme Court and some of the justices were there in attendance. What stood out to you about that scene?
Well, I was struck by the demeanor of the four current justices who were there, both liberal and conservative. Even more than usual, they looked distinctly and unusually uncomfortable as they sat like robed statues in their seats, barely moving during what was a raucous and very partisan event. Chief Justice John Roberts, who's repeatedly stressed the court's role as an independent legal arbiter, has never liked this event, nor have the other justices who show up as a duty. But the chief especially cannot have been happy when Trump, while leaving the chamber, was caught on camera telling Roberts, "Thank you again, I won't forget," apparently referring to the Chief Justice's opinion last summer granting Trump broad immunity from prosecution, even while out of office.
Well, what does that likely mean for the relationship between the new Trump administration and the Supreme Court going forward?
I think we can mark this week as the beginning of a monumental struggle between the court, or at least five members of the court, and the administration's effort to do big things not authorized by Congress, or to, as in this case, stop funds that were authorized by Congress. Now, you can't over or underestimate this, but while Trump repeatedly reminded everyone last night of the extraordinary things he's done in 43 days, remember that in that time period, close to 100 lawsuits have been filed seeking to block those actions for a variety of reasons.
So to get back to this lawsuit, the case decided today on foreign aid, what were the specifics?
The Trump administration appealed to the Supreme Court asking it to block a lower court order issued by a federal judge, Amir Ali. That order required the government to essentially pay its bills, in this case to pay foreign aid contractors for work they'd already completed. And while that order was temporary, the judge is hearing arguments later this week on whether he should impose a more permanent order. Enter the Supreme Court, which today formally refused to block Ali's order, while at the same time telling the judge to, quote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill to ensure compliance with the order and with due regard for the feasibility of timelines. In other words, the court majority basically said to Judge Ali, and by inference to other federal district court judges handling these dozens and dozens of cases, that if you dot your I's and cross your T's appropriately, we'll probably back you up.
So if this was a first tentative shot across the bow, as these dozens of other cases come up, how did the court votes shake out?
The majority one-page order was unsigned, but joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, both conservatives, as well as liberal justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Justice Samuel Alito wrote an 8-page dissent for the four conservative dissenters. "I am stunned," he said, "that the court is rewarding an act of judicial hubris and imposes a $2 billion penalty on American taxpayers." And joining him in dissent were Justices Clarence Thomas and Trump appointees Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch.
This is an unusual 5-4 lineup, with some of the more conservative justices joining the court's three liberals. Is this a 5-4 division that you expect we will see more of as these cases percolate?
It appears that we probably will. I think some people might have expected Justice Kavanaugh to join the Chief Justice, but he is a firm believer in executive power, having served as President Bush's staff secretary, essentially. And he obviously has a very strong view of executive power.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Paul Cotter. More than 40 years ago, when Cotter's father was in his early 50s, he began to show signs of early onset Alzheimer's disease. But no one suspected cognitive decline, and his father lost job after job.
He was no longer able to make decisions, and he couldn't handle the slightest amount of pressure. Since there was no medical explanation given for what he was going through, everyone assumed he was having a crisis of confidence, and he was told that he needed to pull himself together. My father, as you can imagine, felt totally humiliated. After he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, he was horrified by the news, but I imagine he also felt some sense of relief. Finally, there was an explanation for his decline. And in spite of it all, he still wanted to keep working. And this is where my unsung hero stepped in. It wasn't a single person, but a whole company. A small firm located in our hometown in Buffalo offered my father a job, knowing full well that he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. They hired my father to handle small tasks like making copies. They gave him a paycheck, which made him feel needed and valued. But more than just a job, they gave him respect, dignity, and a sense of purpose at a time when his life was falling apart. Unfortunately, my father's disease ultimately progressed to the point where he was having problems keeping his balance. One day at work, he fell off a small stepladder. He wasn't hurt, but it was clear to everyone that it was no longer safe for him to continue working. The company told my father and my mother in a very compassionate way that it was with deep regret that they'd have to let him go. On my father's final day on the job, they threw him a party to thank him for his service. What a beautiful, remarkable gesture that was. I wish my brothers, my sister, and I could remember the name of this company. 40 years later, we don't know if they're still in business or what happened to them. If I could see them today, I would tell them, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Your kindness during my father's final chapter will never be forgotten.
Paul Cotter lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Last week, we heard from a young public health worker in Iowa named Bree McNulty, who'd been terminated abruptly over email in February amid a slew of federal workforce dismissals. Well, yesterday, McNulty got an equally surprising email hiring her back. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has this update on the bewildering situation facing some federal employees.
A lot has happened since I last spoke to Bree McNulty about a week ago. In that time, an old boss at Penn State had already offered to hire the 23-year-old back. She's made plans to move out of Iowa City, where she'd moved in late 2023 to take a prestigious fellowship with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She's even found a new place to live near the new job.
Yesterday morning, I had signed the offer letter. I signed my lease for an apartment. And I was in the parking lot of FedEx to return my CDC laptop and everything.
But McNulty decided to check email on the laptop one last time. That's when she saw the subject line, read this email immediately.
You should return to duty under your previous work schedule We apologize for any disruption that this may have caused.
McNulty says once again, she wasn't sure what to make of it all.
It's sketchy again because the email is from a contact we don't have. We've never gotten anything from employee notifications at cdc.gov. And it's also not signed off by anyone. It just says thanks, comma, and that's the email. And also, the apology for any disruption this may have caused is just salt in the wound, if I'm being honest.
McNulty grew up dreaming of working in public health at the CDC. The pandemic solidified that commitment. She was among an elite group of 66 fellows chosen by the agency in 2023 to help various public health efforts around the country. McNulty was assigned to the Iowa Cancer Consortium, a small group working on statewide efforts to combat what is the country's second highest cancer rate. McNulty says that dream job soured suddenly like a bad romance.
The way I'm like kind of thinking about this is that this has been such an abusive relationship in the sense of like we got let go and now this is the job or the abusive partner like texting us randomly again asking what we're up to.
Kelly Wells-Siddig is executive director for Iowa Cancer Consortium and had been McNulty's boss until 3 weeks ago. Siddig says CDC has informed her nothing about plans to bring back McNulty or the agency's elite public health associate program that sponsored her.
There's so much uncertainty and lack of clarity, not only in this situation, but I think in a lot of other ways about resources that are going to be available for things like cancer control, but also more broadly, public health, healthcare, research.
Bree McNulty decided not to take back the CDC job, but it's not for lack of loving it or the work.
I don't trust the job to last again. And I personally have kind of come to this point of CDC is not off the table for life for me, but it is off the table for the next 4 years.
McNulty says she hopes that those working in public health, like her, will focus on surviving to see better days.
We can't focus on progress when they're trying to dismantle all these agencies and organizations. So we need to focus on making sure we don't lose what we already have, but we can't think about going forward.
CDC spokespeople did not respond to requests seeking comment. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Donald Trump today delayed new tariffs on automobiles, but other tariffs against goods from Canada, China, and Mexico are now in effect. Trump continues to link these tariffs to fentanyl and overdose deaths, including in his speech to Congress last night and again on social media today. But many of his statements about the fentanyl crisis are not true. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Juana.
Brian, fentanyl has been a big public health crisis in the U.S. How does President Trump link that to trade and tariffs?
So Trump argues that these three big trade partners, Canada, China, and Mexico, are also key players in fentanyl smuggling. And last night, he specifically singled out Canada and Mexico.
They've allowed fentanyl to come into our country at levels never seen before, killing hundreds of thousands of our citizens and many very young, beautiful people, destroying families.
And Trump said on social media that he spoke again with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today and told him Canada has weak border policies and has to do more to stop drug smugglers.
Let me ask you this. Does Canada play a big part in the fentanyl crisis?
No. And Juana, this is really where Trump's statements clearly aren't factual. Experts all say Canada is responsible for almost no street fentanyl entering the U.S. In a speech yesterday, Trudeau spoke directly to Trump's accusation.
Well, that is totally false. Far less than 1% of fentanyl flows and less than 1% of illegal crossings into the United States comes from Canada.
President Trump says he simply doesn't believe that. Writing on social media, he claimed without providing evidence that Canadian policies are responsible for the deaths of many people in the U.S. It's not clear now what Canadians can do about this fentanyl issue, given that the amount coming across the northern border appears close to zero.
Brian, what about Mexico?
Yeah, this piece is more complicated. Experts generally agree Mexican officials allowed drug cartels to grow for years with very little law enforcement pressure. Fentanyl from Mexican drug labs contributed to tens of thousands of overdose deaths in the U.S. since this crisis began. And speaking last night, President Trump said tariff pressure is forcing Mexico to do more.
Mexican authorities, because of our tariff policies being imposed on them, think of this, handed over to us 29 of the biggest cartel leaders in their country. That has never happened before. They want to make us happy.
And one of that was a major blow to the cartels and a real win for the Trump administration.
What does the Mexican government have to say about the fentanyl problem?
Yeah, so what they say is that they've been ramping up their cooperation with the U.S. against the cartels since President Claudia Sheinbaum took office last year, working with the Biden administration and then more closely with the Trump administration. Speaking yesterday, Sheinbaum said U.S. tariffs are misguided given how much progress is being made.
Hemos trabajado y dado resultados en materia de seguridad.
We have been working and delivering results in the area of safety. For example, in the case of fentanyl trafficking, the data from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection alone show that fentanyl seizures in the U.S. coming from Mexico have gone down by 50%.
Chinese officials, too, want to say they've stepped up drug interdiction efforts dramatically, and it seems to be helping. Drug deaths are down 25% in the U.S. All these countries say they're going to retaliate with tariffs of their own.
NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann, thank you.
Thank you.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the military will trim 8% from its budget in each of the next 5 years. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports on one target that's already been named.
It was the first thing, in fact, that Hegseth mentioned during a recent news conference when asked about the cuts.
Look at a lot of the climate programs that have been pursued at the Defense Department.
The way he sees it, that's not part of the mission.
Defense Department is not in the business of climate change, solving the global thermostat. We're in the business of deterring and winning wars.
But that business of deterring enemies and winning wars means the military has to plan years, even decades ahead. Decades in which climate change is expected to swamp some coastal installations, increase the number of days it's too hot to train outside, force changes to ships and military equipment, and shape the nature of combat and where conflicts occur. That's why Pentagon leaders have long incorporated climate change into their planning.
There's essentially
nothing that the Department of Defense is doing related to climate change that is only a purely environmental purpose.
Tom Ellison is with the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, D.C. He says Congress has long supported the military's need to plan for climate change, what he calls a rare bipartisan bright spot on the topic. That's because for the military, it's an immediate practical matter.
If you want a capable and healthy U.S. military and fighting force, you need to understand things like how is extreme heat and pollution affecting the health of your troops? When climate change changes the chemistry of the ocean, how is my submarine sonar going to work differently? You know, how will changes in humidity affect the lift capacity of my transport aircraft, right? How will climate change affecting crop yields cause food price spikes and instability?
He says even things like making military vehicles more fuel efficient are about warfighting.
That's something that has environmental benefits, right? But when you had troops in Iraq and Afghanistan getting killed, delivering fuel supplies to forward operating bases, if you use less fuel, you have less of a need for that.
Also, building resilience into the military's infrastructure planning has become critical. Increasingly common and more powerful storms have caused billions of dollars in damage to installations. Some key coastal bases already experience regular flooding, so new barracks, say, or piers for ships must be designed for higher sea levels. And experts say some, like the Marine Corps' iconic Paris Island, will eventually have to be abandoned and their missions shifted elsewhere. It's early in the budget-cutting process, but one sign of what might come is the disappearance of an official online portal that helped military leaders plan for a changing climate. Carolyn Baxter, now retired from the Defense Department, oversaw the portal's creation.
That portal was meant to give people resources and one place to go for those resources that they can then use to figure out, all right, I'm a logistician. What do I need to know about changing sea level rise? How do I make a decision about that? I'm an installation manager. How is sea level rise going to affect any expansion of the installation that I'm supposed to manage?
The Defense Department didn't respond to a request for comment, but Baxter says dropping climate initiatives would come at a cost to military planning and national security.
There is a math and physics about climate change, and that has been true for decades, that has made what they do harder and will continue to make what they do harder. Norfolk flooding, Annapolis flooding 40 times a year, wildfires taking the Kentucky National Guard off mission, stuff like that.
In the real world, she says, heat and sea level rise and storms are increasingly destructive forces that the U.S. military must deal with, enemies that can't be ignored. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state.
No, don't stop the carnival.